Okay, so my name is Eun-gun Moon, and you can call me EG because almost no one pronounced my name. So, yeah, I'm a postdoc here. I just started my postdoc last September, and so I'm postdoc here, Santa Barbara, with Shenke and Leon. And before that, I studied at Harvard and under Subir's supervision. Right. Any question? Probably not. Okay. First of all, thank you very much for giving me a chance to give a talk, even though I haven't done almost nothing related to graphene. So I tried to find something I haven't done. And this is the most related one because it is on the honeycomb lattice. So what I'm going to talk about today is honeycomb lattice, and I turn on the some interaction. So try to find some interesting physics with interaction physics. Okay. So here is my title: superfluid phases on honeycomb lattice near half Philly. If you feel weird, then intuition is correct, basically. So near half-filling, it is almost impossible to have superfluid because there is no Fermi surface in this case, so superconductivity does not appear. Ah, by the way, so I have two S here. So one is because in my mind, I'm gonna use monolayer and bilayer structure, basically, hoping. So basically, Lorentz theory is described by the particle, and this is the quadratic band plotting. And superfluid phases, as Mian said, I'm going to consider charged neutral. And another one is charged, basically. So this is just usual superfluid, and this is superconductive. Okay, so here are some references. I can give you a lot more, but this is the most important one. The last one is, it's not done yet, so hopefully I can finish this work this week or next week, and I can put up this work to the archive. Or maybe I can add some authors. So this is not done work, so any comments are welcome. Okay. Okay, let me get started. So first thing I want to discuss is monolayer, of course, easier one. What I mean by monolayer is a Lorentz theory is basically a particle. So I start my system writing like this, always. So this is non-interacting part, and this is the interaction part. So as usual, we have the honeycomb lattice, A, B, and the H naught is we all know. Like this. Okay, and then if you prefer Lorentz theory, then you can write this something like this. More kind of fancy, but the meaning is basically true. So in this talk, I'm going to use three different matrices, power matrices. So sigma is for the sublattice. And what is this? Rho is for the valley. S is for the spin. So these three kinds of matrices will be introduced. And here, so this is a sublattice, and valley index is here. So k and minus k in this notation has different chirality or helicity. So momentum space is basically like this. Right. So now let's turn on the interaction. And then the easiest one is basically how about you? Something like this. And probably, so this is an example. Another interaction, let's call this zero. And it's basically the detail is not important. So, but important thing is how about you is on site. And the second example is the basically next nearest neighbor interaction. So interaction between here, and this one is interaction between neighbor. So then, if we increase, so let's consider interaction physics. Interaction is much bigger than one. And in this case, we all know that this becomes new phase. This becomes quantum spinor. This becomes transient wave. So far, good. This is known, and you can do it by yourself. Calculation. So, yeah, last week or 2 weeks ago, Fokker gave a talk about this stuff. So he gave a talk about near here, semi-metal, new, and then he finds some kind of spinity here. But I'm not going to discuss about this. But I think interesting question is, if I turn on really large, is there any intermediate region similar to this spin liquid? That could be an interesting question, I think. Okay. So there are many ways, other than that, there are many ways to break symmetry of the system. This system has a lot of symmetry, including spin rotation symmetry. But I'm going to focus on these two interactions, basically. In other words, I'm going to focus on these two. And if I have time, I briefly mention about this charge density wave order. So, in this phase diagram, so my starting point is basically nil phase. So I'm starting from here. So the ground state is described by the order parameter, basically. This one is U over G. Yeah. So the ground state, it has some non-zero order parameter, and so it is basically, suppose I have these guys, and then let's consider some skirmion of this physics. Skirmion. So this particle, so in this system, I had spin SU2 symmetry, and then I break it down to U1, because once I break the spin, I can rotate around this axis. So ground state manifold is basically S2, which means I have skirmion. Skirmion is possible in this system. Okay. So what is skirmion? Well, we all know what is skirmion. So skirmion is basically I have fixed order parameter at the boundary, and at the center there is one configuration, and there is some spin texture basically. It's hard to draw. So basically this configuration wraps your space for the skirmion in this case. Okay. So and let's consider this skirmion configuration. So it should be spatial. So this is the skirmion configuration. Let's suppose this is skirmion configuration. Then what you can do is just introduce G, G, another some coupling constant or some parameter. If G is zero, then it becomes just one, just the ground state. If G is one, then you can see this becomes the skirmion configuration. This configuration. What am I doing this? Oh, you'll see. why I am doing this, to introduce superfluid, basically. So, right, with this, you can calculate your Hamiltonian. So you can calculate, basically, your Hamiltonian H naught plus some mass. So basically, this one opened the gap at the Dirac particle. So it introduced mass gap. And then you can write down water parameter, something like this, at the low-end theory. Or you can go to the original theory and calculate everything. But basically, they are equivalent. And if you solve this equation, then what you get, so there are some special variation from this. So it is impossible to solve this analytically. So you need to use computer. So put this Hamiltonian to computer and let the computer compute. And what you get is basically, so this is G, the parameter G. So at zero, there is energy gap. This is energy. And this is state. And if I focus on at only one value, suppose I'm at the k or one value, k, so rho g is 1, basically. In this case, what you can see is basically there is one state comes here and down here. So one state comes from the conduction band to the valence band. What does that mean? Is basically your skirmion carries charge. So this part, there is one skirmion, and here no skirmion. So this means once you put skirmion, charge is induced. One charge is induced at value k.
Okay. Is it charge or dipole moment?
Charge is induced, basically.
Why is it charge? Because you have two sublattices. You can use the argument about the charge separately on each sublattice. And you will have two opposite charges.
Okay, so yeah, so that question is relevant later. But at this point, I will only focus on one value. So if I consider two values, then it becomes
two. No, it's not two values. You're speaking about the electromagnetic state, right?
Right.
So two sublattices will support polarizations of the opposite direction. So I can apply your argument about vector n to one sublattice and to the other sublattice, and I'll get two charges.
No, we need to think sublattice together to break the... To open the gap, we need to break that together. We need to consider. We need to break inverted symmetry, AB. So basically, nearly is the AB. So I need to consider these together, these sublattices together, and that's the spinner basically here.
Maybe one step back, I'm wondering what this quantity S stands for. Could you say please once more what's
S?
Yes.
S is defined here, spin. So I'm going to use Pauli's spin matrix. So S is SX, XY, SG. And then your order parameters can change this.
No, but your skirmion is S. The order parameter is S multiplied by sigma Z. So whatever you do with one sublattice, you do the opposite thing on the other sublattice.
Right. So they
for one sublattice you have charge plus, on the other sublattice you have charge minus.
No. They together pulls the one charge basically.
But the other value has no other charge.
Sure. I mean yes, basically. Right. Because skirmion, I mean I'll explain that later, but skirmion is reflection invert. And if I reflect, then sign is changed. So helicity or chirality becomes very important in this talk. And that's why near and quantum spinner affects differently. So behaves differently. Maybe we can discuss it later. Okay, so Or if you don't like this, or if you like more field theory calculation, then you can do the field theory calculation. And what you, once you do, you can get this equation. This equation tells if this is just nothing but something like this. I didn't define gamma mu, but you know what this means, basically. So this J, the big J, is nothing but the skirmion. Something like this. So as he mentioned, if I focus on J0, which means a density, then this one becomes NA. Something like this. So if I flip one index, one coordinate sign, like k and minus k, then y becomes changes, so the charge becomes negative. So which means each value has different carries different skirmion charge. Which means if I consider k prime, where rho z is minus 1, in this case, one skirmion, so we are focusing on near phase right now, so one skirmion, the charge becomes negative, so delta q here is positive, and delta q is negative. So we are discussing with near phase. And near phase skirmion. Has plus 1 or plus q from the k. This is contribution from k. And minus q. This is minus k. So this is charge. Is zero. Yeah, so you have mu of the parameter, and then you have skirmion of this mu of the parameter, then this charge is zero. And if you do more calculation, you can show that this is boson. So if you're interested in, by the way, if you're interested in the field theory method, you can look up Goldstone Richard paper, and there they explain a lot. However, the interesting part is charge of skirmion and quorum spin of case. So this is the cross k. The important thing is there is minus, one minus is minus. So this is 2q. And this is boson. Where this minus comes from is basically, where is all the parameter? I didn't write all the parameter here. All the parameter is near phase cases. All the parameter is you need to break inversion symmetry and then spin symmetry. So this is near the parameter. And quantum spin cases, inversion symmetry breaking, and then time reversal invariant basically. So this all the parameter does not break time reversal symmetry. N?
Yeah.
N is the
low.
Yeah, low is the value.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. So it doesn't break the time reversal symmetry with that. Right. So there is 2q boson, which means if I consider charge 1, it becomes charge 2, basically. So this is a charge 2 boson, and this is charge 1, charge 0 boson. Now, so far, I haven't done any cheating. So far, what we have is basically consider interaction, so this Hamiltonian. And suppose I add another interaction. So in this Hamiltonian, this configuration, skirmion configuration is the excited state, basically. But let's add some interaction. And suppose this interaction tries to kill mean order coherently. And then I briefly mentioned about this property of the interaction, this part. But suppose I have some interaction. This interaction tries to kill mean order parameter coherently. And suppose this one adds some fugacity of the skirmions. And then what we can guess is basically, so V interaction can induce near to superfluid. If I condense boson, then I get the superfluid. And if I condense charged boson, then I get the superconductivity. So this part is discussed on the Centius paper, Centius and Grover's paper. And right. So it is likely to have first order phase transition because this one breaks the spin rotation symmetry, and this will break the number conserving symmetry. But there are some proposals, these two phases can be connected continuously. So if I have time, I'll discuss that more. But probably I don't. And okay, let me just mention the result. So if I believe the proposal is nothing but the 4-pi nonlinear sigma model, with West Juno written K one. Level is one. This is the proposal. If you're interested, I can discuss this later. And so right, so far, so this is done. This work is almost done in the literature. And the new thing is let's consider bilayer. If I consider bilayer, then theory becomes more ugly. But you can guess what will happen. And you can check. So there's one, C2, and there's curve, interlayer hopping. And then Lorentz theory becomes basically my square. You all know this. Why? And then everything is almost the same, but there's one difference here. There's one difference, which means there is one more charge here. So for the bilayer cases, there are the topological number is basically double. We all know this from the Berry phase calculation. I mean, we are familiar with this calculation. So for the monolayer cases, we have pi, but Berry phase or bilayer case is 2 pi. So it is topological. So one argument for this is topological number should behave similarly. So one argument for this double charge is basically analogy of Berry phase, or you can add very nice disorder to the system to split this dispersion. So what I've been touching is like this. Once you add small disorder, then you can create something like this kind of 2 Dirac points, and then do calculation, and you can match. Of course, this distance is proportional to this distance. So above this energy scale, it's still quadratic. But at Lorentz scale, if we only focus on the Lorentz scale, it becomes basically Dirac part. Okay. So then this becomes 2e, so double, which means charge skirmion near case is 0, but this becomes 4, basically, and then. For the monolayer case is need to superfluid phase tension, but quantum spin, but for the bilayer cases, this one becomes fully superconductive. And we haven't seen any fully superconductivity yet, but this is could be one proposal for the charge fully superconductivity.
Excuse me, what is the symmetry of the order parameter in the superconducting state?
Pairing symmetry?
Yeah.
Probably S wave.
Because, how do you get that? What determines it in your model?
What determines in my model? So, it is difficult to say. I mean, yeah, it is quite difficult to determine which order parameter is the best.
It follows from the, because one time commute with the matrices, that three matrices that you have with the quantum spin hole.
Sure. Right.
And it's S-way, that's just so the phi matrices that anti commute.
Sure.
It's basically fixed structure. So if you have three that already anti commute, you can only add two that fill it. Completely to
fine.
And for the three quantum spin hole matrices,
it's
the S superconductor.
I'm not sure about that. So yeah, we can discuss it later. But monolayer case, okay, this four is superconductivity, I'm not sure, but monolayer case is S wave. That's for sure. So that's.
There are other options.
Yeah, there are options, right.
In particular cases, S-wave.
Right. So for the monolayer case, and quantum spin order to 2e superconductivity, that's S wave.
That's what I meant. Actually.
Yeah. Okay.
So those other options are determined by the Hamiltonian, or do you have?
They are determined by the three matrices that you chose for the quantum spin hole.
Right.
That leaves, that determines completely.
So it's basically related to Dirac matrices in the 2 plus 1 dimension and in this system.
So he also will have the pulsor due to charges.
Repulsion.
Cool repulsion.
Sure. Okay. Like I said, this is very theoretical proposal, and I haven't discussed anything about this free interaction. So if I have some Coulomb interaction, and if I consider that this is quite, I don't know how it is realistic this is, but at least we can check. I mean, we can try to find new exotic superconductivity on computer because this model can be tested on the computer if it is good enough. Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Any question?
No time for questions.
Okay.
Questions are fine.
Hear me without the microphone. Let's try to get out. So I have been working on the problem of exciton condensation in double layer graphene. So I'm going to summarize the results that we have obtained in this problem. So by the way, I'm Inti Sullivan, a student of Alan McDonough, a third-year grad student. I've been working on this together with another postdoc in the group. It's Lima Peskin. Okay, so the basic idea is that we have two single layer graphene sheets separated by a distance. So this is not a bilayer in the sense of a single particle hybridized layers. I'll start there, but just two monolayers of graphene separated by some distance. And electrons in each layer interact with the electrons in the other layer via Coulomb interactions. And so the idea is that by applying gate voltages, we can induce electric fields in the layers so that one is doped to have electrons, say this one, and the other one is built to have holes. Because of this gating, there will be an offset in the direct cones of the two layers controlled by the gate voltages. So we have, say, an electron node layer here is the chemical potential, and a hole node layer. And because the electrons and holes will attract via Coulomb interactions, there is a weak coupling instability to open up a gap for the system, for the electrons and holes in different layers to pair up and form this exciton condensate. So very analogous to the BCS superfluid, the BCS instability. So there has been a lot of controversy about the size of the gap in this system. The problem is that even though it's known that there is going to be a weak coupling instability, estimating the size of the gap is hard because of determining the screen, the way the electron-electron interactions are screened is not easy. So the basic argument of why the gap has to be small is just a conventional BCS argument. So in BCS, the gap has to scale exponentially with the effective interactions in the system. So you have some density of states of the Fermi energy and some effective interactions. And these effective interactions, if you use some kind of Thomas Fermi screening, static screening of Coulomb interactions, is roughly the strength of the Coulomb interactions divided by some screening that usually scales in this way. There's some extra 1/2 because of the suppression of backscattering in graphene. So at very strong interactions, this goes like 1/2. So n here is the number of flavors per graphene layer, per Dirac cone, let's say. So it will go like 1/4 n. So this BCS gap will essentially go like, in this fashion,
in your notation,
yeah, so it will be very small. Graphene has four internal degrees of freedom. So it will be a very small gap if you follow this argument. But before going into what we actually need, the technicalities of what we need to, so my job somehow is to bring this value up. So before going into the technicalities of that, I wanna make a general argument why this gap has to be large, much larger than the value at strong interactions. By that I mean when the fine structure constant is very large. So this might be a very academic argument, but the basic point is just to show that this gap can be indeed large at strong interactions. And this argument is entirely mine, so if it's crap, it wouldn't be surprising, but anyway, so the basic point is if this interlayer separation is much smaller than the average separation between carriers in each layer, I mean, there's not really a separation, but if this parameter is very small, at long wavelengths, the interactions, the electron-electron interactions will not distinguish between same layer electrons and opposite layer electrons. So the effective interactions will be invariant under this internal degree of freedom of which layer the electrons are in. So we will have in the case in which there is no doping, we will have essentially at long wavelengths a model that is equivalent to graphene with an extra internal degree of freedom, which is the layer index. So if we don't gate the system, so if the permeability energy is zero, in the way that I defined it there, we will have essentially graphene with 2n degrees of freedom, and mean 4, so 8 degrees of freedom, let's say. And it's known that this system has an instability, strong interactions. So for some alpha, for some fine structure constant, that is a function of the number of degrees of freedom, we expect this system to have an interaction, to have an instability, to open up a gap. And that is, we think the Dirac model, whatever phase comes out of that instability has to be dominated by ultraviolet physics, because the model doesn't have any energy scale. So in the case of the honeycomb layer, and the honeycomb lattice, there is this argument that this will be an anti-ferromagnet, and the gap will be dominated by those kind of scales, lattice scales in the model. But the point is that within a Dirac model, this there will be necessarily a critical interaction strength that is a function of the number of internal degrees of freedom at which this gap will open. So if we imagine perturbing this slightly modified graphene model with something that I pursue is an infrared perturbation that is just shifting the cones by a small amount in one of these degrees of freedom, I would expect that in this system, since the system doesn't have any energy scale other than this small shifting of the two cones, there must be a critical interaction where this system will open up a gap dominated by ultraviolet physics, just because of its parametric proximity to this original model. So if we have this system, which is essentially what I have there in the exciton condensation case, in the case in which the two layers are very close to each other, I would argue that you will have a very small gap here, a weak coupling. But necessarily beyond this fine structure constant, this critical fine structure constant, this gap has to grow up within the Dirac model and be dominated by the ultraviolet scales. In this case, the one ultraviolet scale that will come into play will be, in terms of momentum, will be the Dirac velocity times this interlayer separation. So by that argument, I want to say that necessarily the system has to get away from that BCS regime and strong coupling. So what did we do in technical terms to understand this, how this might happen? So we took essentially the simplest approach to deal with the to describe the screening of the interactions, and the fact that the phase in which the screening is happening is a gap phase. So we essentially took the effective interactions between layers and modeled them in this way. If this is top layer, let's say an electron in the top layer interacting with an electron in the bottom layer, this will be, so we just use RPH essentially, that's what I'm going to say, with a modification.
The better interaction between the two electrons,
plus some screening of this better interaction. But the big functions that we use to calculate these polarizabilities are calculated in the gap phase. So they implicitly depend on the gap of the system, this polarizability. And how do we determine the gap? Well, it's just self-consistently by calculating the Dyson equation. So we will have an anomalous Green's function because there is a hybridization of electrons between the two layers in the exciton condensate. So the Green's functions can propagate between top and bottom layer. So we determine the central energy using the simplest approach, with this screen interaction being this one that depends implicitly on the gap. So this is the gap, essentially. And we have these indices being at top and bottom layer. So with this self-consistent framework, we calculated the gap. But the important ingredients is that we are keeping the not only the momentum dependence, but the frequency dependence of these screened interactions, and the fact that the screening happens in the gap phase. So I want to show you what are the results. Let me just comment quickly for a further simplification that we made to calculate what this here and estimate of this gap.
Do you include intra-layer interaction?
Intra-layer, so, yes.
Yeah, so this wavy line is both top-bottom and top-top-bottom-bottom.
Yeah, so this interaction here is a matrix.
Yeah,
okay. So, yeah, it's when these two indices are in the same layer, you have just the bare Coulomb interactions. And when the two indices are in different layers, you have the Coulomb interaction between different layers. So let me show you that. So to calculate the gap.
Do you calculate gap or TC?
We calculate the gap at zero temperature. We did not calculate directly the critical temperature. So what I wanted to say is the gap equation that we get is the gap of any frequency momentum and in the imaginary axis. Same gap square plus the dispersion square, the bare dispersion square plus the frequency square times the effective interactions between different layers, this be the screen, at the transfer momentum of the and there is the suppression of Bach's vacuum factor. It's typical for graphene.
I have a question about this. That gap equation looks to me like a pretty ordinary gap equation.
Yeah, it's
which is usually not obtained from the self energy, but obtained from scattering two particles off each other repeatedly.
No, so this gap equation looks like very much like the strong coupling gap equation in superconductors.
But in superconductors,
why is it obtained from the self energy?
But in superconductors, you have a ladder in vertical direction in these diagrams, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is particle Hall's channel, basically.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It looks similar to the superconductor mm-hmm. because in one case you have epsilon k and one case you have minus epsilon k. So to dispersion of the two layers is epsilon k and minus epsilon k. So it effectively looks like the superconductor, but it's actually in the particle Hall channel.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so this Green's function that goes from top to bottom would be the anomalous Green's function in this superconducting case.
Yeah. So I have another question. When you made this little estimate here at the beginning,
yes.
Why did you not have a D in it? You seem to not meet the D at all.
This estimate somehow is only the limit in which D is very small.
Okay.
So that would be the best case scenario, let's say, to find the D in the specific function of this thing for.
But D has to be larger than a certain size, otherwise it is a tunnel coupled, right? I mean,
yeah, in the real problem. But let's say if the gap is very small, even when D is 0,
so
then there won't be actually
a second order
function.
Typical limit of D?
Right?
Typical limit of D?
Sorry?
What is the typical number for D? Where?
Well, it depends on what you use, right? But I would say that a nanometer, maybe the experimental is one. A nanometer would still be a distance in which you would have a hybridization
The equation you get is exactly the same as has led to the estimate you have there, except that the interaction you put in here, you suppress screening by saying that you have a gap and calculate the different polarization.
But they did not include the dynamic screening.
We did include dynamic screening, and we also got the 1 over n expansion result with some corrections in the exponential. The problem you have with your approach is the following. And it's the same problem that people who do GW encounter.
Mm-hmm.
When they continue the approximations, the GW steps
mm-hmm.
beyond the first step and do not take into account vertex corrections. Because what you have to do with your polarization loop here is to calculate this, which is called the Zipponic correction. And then this will dump the polarization operator down to the same as it was in the single particle problem without any order prime. And then you go back to the screened, unaffected by the gap, dynamical interaction, and you will end up with a result similar to what Yefetov got.
I think the other way of doing it was basically if you do it in the high temperature phase. I mean, if you're looking for TC, then you can do the usual just screening.
Or you come from TC, from
yeah,
above,
from above
and you always end up with,
The same number.
With the same number.
I agree. Yeah. That's
so let me ask.
No, but so what the argument is the following, that we don't believe in second order phase transitions, we believe only in the first order phase transitions. Okay?
Good.
Okay. Let's believe. But let's do it in the way that the excitonic corrections are taken into account. And I think that if this is done properly,
so
it will go back to
the same order and it just reverts you back.
Well, I can tell our own experience. We did the following. We did the bilayer with the gap. So we have the flattened parabolic spectrum. And this was the single particle gap. Then we calculated the screened interaction, which is much less screened. And then we got normalization of the single particle parameter. And then from this, we got logarithmic enhancement of the single particle gap, suppression of single particle weight. Then you can do two things. You can take the new larger gap, put it in the polarization operator, then you start seeing that the whole procedure falls apart, because at the next step, when you take into account the larger gap in the polarization operator, you get even less screening. But this is incorrect. So what we did, we took into account it's and then it was all stabilized.
So for example, if you calculate Goldstone modes around this, you'll find your Goldstone modes to be gapped if you
And the point is the following, that if you now take this single particle gap in the schema, and then on this scale you put the renormalized single particle gap, that would be fine. But the exciponic energy stays about twice the single particle gap. Well, we create the electron in the hole. I shouldn't multiply it. I shouldn't have multiplied it. I took the whole gap. So the exciton energy stayed at about the same way as the single particle. So there is no.
But in the strong coupling theory in conventional superconductors, you don't include these corrections, right?
But you start with a state. In usual superconductors, you look for second order phase transition. You start with the phase which is normal state, and you take the polarization operator in the normal state when you put in here interaction. You don't put interaction in the state which already has
for strong coupling superconductors, you don't need the vertex corrections, but that's the main value. It's very specific to the electron phonon interaction, not to electron electron interactions. It's completely different.
And there's no equivalent Mingdahl's theorem here.
But you have still two more years to include the polarization.
Maybe just doing the experiment would be quicker and then
what did you do?
I'm gonna show the results essentially with this approach. So this is the basic result that we obtained in this limit of single interlayer separation as a function of the fine structure constant. And so the different plots are for different numbers of the degeneracy of the diacoms. So this one is graphene, and this is what you get as you decrease the degeneracy of the diacoms, and this is what you get if you use bare Coulomb interactions. So essentially, what we obtain is that there are two regimes. A very weak coupling, the gap is essentially zero compared with the Fermi energy scale. But as you increase the interaction strength, there is a critical interaction in which the gap rises to become of the order of the Fermi energy. So,
what is alpha?
Alpha is E squared over B. But we assume that there might be some extrinsic reduction of alpha from the surrounding dielectric medium. So we have, say, the result as a function of alpha. So graphene in the vacuum would be somewhere near 2.2.
Okay.
What is bare?
Bare is if you use unscreened Coulomb interaction. So if you put effectively n equals 0.
Sorry, so graphene in vacuum, you cannot make that device, right? If you are making one layer, putting an insulator, putting another layer, it's at least there is one insulating layer between.
Insulating layer in between is not never a problem, because when you polarize, you do not add any charges. You do not move charges to the infinity. I mean, vacuum slab doesn't do anything.
Vacuum itself is a very good insulator, right? So
yeah, but you cannot make the deep. So you're saying
I can do it in theory, right? So at least if it doesn't work, no. But the point is, if in vacuum it would be zero, then we know that in any real material it would be.
And what is n? Sorry, I missed. What is capital N?
N is the number of degrees of freedom per Dirac cone. So this is graphene that has spin and valley. And this would be, say, a topological insulator, or just a model of a simple Dirac cone, say, it's n equals 1.
So why does the n matter?
Because you increase the number of degrees of freedom, you increase the screening, right? This polarization function of
screening has your n. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so and this is a comparison of the calculation for graphene using different approaches. So if instead of the full calculation, we would do the calculation using polarization functions that are frequency independent and calculated using static screening, we get this result. So this is our already scale. The gap is many orders of magnitude smaller than the Fermi energy. If we use polarization functions that include the frequency dependence or have dynamic screening, but in the gapless phase, we get this result, this dashed green curve. And the blue curve is the one that we get in this scheme in which we include the gap into the polarization functions. So essentially, they coincide up to some critical point in which the size of the gap matters itself for the screen. And this result starts deviating from this one, and the gap starts to become the order of the Fermi energy. And interestingly, as a function of interlayer separation, so if we do now the calculation more realistically with a finite separation, and we trace how the gap behaves as a function of interlayer separation, we find that the transition between these two regimes, this regime in which the gap is many orders of magnitude smaller than the Fermi energy, and the regime in which the gap is of the order of the Fermi energy, might occur abruptly. So the transition might be first order. So we essentially there is a red curve here that is zero, that is the where you get a very large separation. This you come along this line that is many much smaller than the Fermi energy, and the function is not single value. There is an unstable branch. But beyond some critical distance, there is a discontinuous change. This plot is for this Fermi energy in which the gap becomes of the Fermi energy. So each of these curves corresponds to different alphas. So this curves are a fixed alpha changing the interlayer separation. And the result is similar if you use different number of internal degrees of freedom per Dirac cone.
So here, suppose I have four nanometer distance, and then your EF is 250, and your gap is almost 200.
Yes.
So then your theory is, I mean, probably you use some approximation in your theory,
yes.
And this approximation still holds in your theory?
Which approximation? I mean,
beta over E actually is some smaller than some number.
Why?
I don't know.
That's the point, right? That it might rise to become the order of the Fermi energy. Of course, critical temperatures may be very different because you have all the constant results of this physics. But the point is that the zero temperature gap can be comparable, at least within these approximations that I described, to the Fermi energy, whether they are right or not. from the
atom. Wouldn't you have seen such a big gap, 200 millielectron volt?
So the point is essentially that there are these two parameters that are very critical, right? So this is how zero interlayer separation. This is alpha. So if you are here, say if you're sitting here, this might be the explanation. Okay, one explanation might be the calculation is wrong, like some people is arguing. Other explanation could be you might be sitting here, so you might be at alpha equals one, right? If you're at alpha equals one, the gap is 10 to the minus 4 times the Fermi energy, so it's unobservable, right? But if you happen to reduce this dielectric screen, this extensive dielectric screen, you might be sitting here and observe a sizable gap. So this, the dependence on these two parameters, the effective alpha and the interlayer separation is dramatic. So it might change from very different scales as a function of the
time. I think what might be bothering people is that your scale on delta is getting as hard, as large as your scale on the
F. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that just seems...
If delta is of the order of epsilon Fermi, then pretty much all hell breaks loose. There is no controlled calculation.
So I guess
both here
approximately
are you
finished?
Yes, essentially. Okay, then we'll discuss afterwards because we have one more speaker. And the previous speaker helps with the board. You leave no trace.
Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk here today. Well, my name is Victor Ochoa. I'm a graduate student of faculty Massachusetts in Madrid. Well, officially, this is my second year of my learning. I probably started to work with Pablo during my master year, so I have been working on working for essentially the last 2 years. So in the past, I worked on the effect of sexual quantums on transfer properties of Alexander Rapin. Essentially the same stuff that Eros Mariani presented in his talk during the conference week. So today I would like to tell you about what I have been doing more recently for the last month in collaboration with Antonio Castaneto, which are problems related with spin-off entropy and spin relaxation. Mechanisms in singularity. So let me write down a tentative outline of my presentation. So first, I would like to remind you just as an introduction, which is the microscopic value. The reading of the spin orbit. Coupling graphene. When I say spin orbit coupling graphene, I mean the effective spin orbit interaction acting over graphene pi electrons. Then I would like to say something about the spin rotation in particular. I would like to discuss really briefly Taylor Jaffe mechanism and the context of singularity graphene. And I will finish with discussing one new idea, which is the effect of textual forms on the spin of the top, in particular the optical textual forms. So, okay, so this is something that is essentially done and actually reposted. Preprint
and you can check the details there. And this is still work in progress, so all comments are welcome. So, well, so the first thing I want to mention about the spin-orbit interaction in Graphene is that it's a very weak effect. First of all, because the interatomic spin-orbit interaction is weak due to the mass of the carbon atom. And second, because the effective coupling between pi electrons is the result of second order processes which involve transistors into the sigma bands. So, for instance, if you think in the usual LS Hamiltonian, in order to describe the intra-atomic spin-orbit interaction. And you write down this angular momentum and spin operators in places of atomic p orbitals, and you can see that this Hamiltonian doesn't mix the p sets, so the p orbitals. So if you want to consider an effective spin-orbit coupling between these states, you must consider processes up to second order. So, well, this interaction constant is the order of 20 million electron volts, according to this reference. Intrinsic spin-orbit coupling acting between pi electrons is the result of this kind of second neighbors processes. Which are actually second order on the interatomic spin-orbit interaction. And well, this kind of processes lead to the Kenny-Mellin spin-orbit coupling, where an estimate of this coupling will be essentially the square of the atomic interaction over an energy scale, must be proportional to the energy difference between the sigma and the pi band. So this is this kind of second neighbor processes in the low energy continuum description, something like the Kenny-Mellin mass term. Which, as you know, is nothing but the two copies of the Halden mass with a different sink for each spin sector, in order to preserve the universal symmetry. So, apart from this, if you consider also mirror symmetry breaking, or in general, special inversion symmetry breaking, then you have also, you can have also first neighbor's properties. For instance, the typical example is the effect of an electric field perpendicular to a graphene sample. Then you have a dipolar transition between the pi and sigma orbitals, and then come back to the pi by the spin interaction. So this is nothing but a Rasmussen coupling, which kind of whose strength would be estimated as essentially what the atomic spin of interaction times on any scale associated to this, for instance, and of course, and any difference between sigma and pi band. So this is typically of the order of 1 microelectron volt, so it's very weak. And this coupling
for instance, if you consider a curvature and the graphene, or the presence of the subset, whatever, but generally it's one of the magnitude higher. So, as you know, this term opens a gap in the spectrum, actually a non-trivial gap, and this term tends to close it, and there is an interesting competition. This term is responsible of, essentially it's responsible for spin relaxation.
So what did you tell me Rajpa was 10 times bigger?
It's 10 times bigger, yes. At least one of them is bigger, yeah. So apart from this picture, there are several interesting proposals to enhance the spin orbiting graphene. A very recent proposal is, for instance, the possibility of engineering a spin hall state by heavy electrons. Deposition which is explained in this PRX paper. And of course the proposal by Paco and Antonio. They discuss the effect of resonance impurities, such as hydrogen, for instance, that are covalently attached to carbon atoms and then induce a local distortion of the lattice coordinations to sp3-like coordinations. And then this kind of distortion leads to enhancement locally of the spin orbit coupling. So that proposal is interesting to. Essentially for spin spin transport experiments. So let me now discuss briefly spin relaxation in graphene. Well, we are interested on spin transport essentially because if you assume that the spin transport in graphene is limited by a spin orbit mediated spin relaxation mechanism, then the spin lifetimes are nothing but a measure, an indirect measure of the strain of the spin of the coupling. So in the literature there are essentially two mechanisms discussed. One is the Jeffers-Perel mechanism, which is consists on an electron spin precession in between scattering units. Essentially because the Rajpa coupling can be seen as an effective magnetic field which acts on the electron spin. And then it's clear that the more scattered events you have, then the longer the spin relaxation time is going to be. So this is characterized by a relation where the spin relaxation time is essentially inverse, or is proportional to the inverse of the momentum in time. This is the Jeffers-Perel. And the other mechanism usually discussed is the Eddie effect, which consists on a spin relaxation during a scattering event. Since spin orbit coupling entangles orbital momentum and spin dynamics, then a change in the direction of momentum implies also a change in the spin polarization. So, and this mechanism is characterized by the Elliott relation, which says that the spin relaxation time is simply proportional to the momentum scattering time. Okay, so this is actually a very nice argument by Eddie to see this. since which is valid, strictly valid in the case of solid with a tender of inversion, because in that case, of course, block state with well-defined spin projection and not longer, in this case, the complete Hamiltonian. But due to the presence of the inversion symmetry, you still have doubly degeneracy. You still have Cramer's doublets that are given momentum k. So, I did construct an argument based on this, where they show that essentially, this relation holds essentially independently of the nature of the precise scattering mechanism. So this relation can be extended to the case of graphene, also in the presence of a rational coupling which breaks inversion symmetry, and this is essentially what the subject of our paper. So the result is that essentially the spin relatives in time scales as the momentum stepping in time times the square of the ratio between the Fermi energy and the strength of the spin of the coupling. As I told you, this is a quite general relation and it's essentially dependent of the nature of the precise scattering mechanism. So this implies that if one assumes that the momentum scattering time or mean feedback is essentially proportional to Kf, so it has a sublinear dependence with the real concentration, then implies that the scattering the spin rotation time has a superlinear behavior as a function of the Carrier concentration, and which this is in apparent contradiction to most of the experimental results, but this is not true at all. Well, you know, most of the experiments show that the LP scales as like this as function of the Carrier concentration, and the same for tau s, except in the case of CVD graphene, and these are experiment by Barbados, so at the other day. In that case, you have the same, but in the case of the spin rotation time, you have a superlinear behavior as function of the Carrier concentration, meaning that probably in this kind of sample, a characteristic defect as grain boundaries are playing a major role in what confers to spin relaxation by these Elliott-Jeffrey mechanisms. Whereas in the other kind of samples, which are cleaner, probably there are other mechanisms playing a role. Probably the one induced by, for instance, resonant impurities, which induce local enhancement of the spin of the coupling. And in that case, there are more channels open to spin flip processes, and there is a clear deviation of this formula. Because essentially, you have to take into account other contributions to this spin relaxation. Also, the formation of local magnetic moments, as the data by Roland O'Connor suggests. So there is a lot to be done in this field, I think. So just to conclude, let me say something about the role of extra points. As I told you before, SP3 light coordination enhances the spin of the coupling simply because you have a non-zero implementation between the pi and sigma orbitals. And that's essentially what Platman and Tony discussed. But this enhancement is due to the presence of the impurity. Clearly, you're breaking the inversion symmetry, the mirror symmetry. So, this is the RASFA coupling is the one of this enhancement. But if you consider a system with a SP3 lack of ignition, preserving inversion symmetry, and that's the case, for example, as the case of Citizen. Do you expect that the only spin on recoupling at all of the symmetries is the case made one? And of course, it's going to be higher than in case of flat graphene. So actually, we perform dynamic calculation by considering both pi and sigma orbitals and taking into account the changes in the copies between pi and sigma orbitals due to this kind of coordination. And what we obtain is that, for instance, in the case of complete SP3 coordination, we obtain a KMA coupling of the order of 1 mV, which is a lot. So the main conclusion of
DFT for silicon gives 1.5.
1.5, 3.5, I think.
One and a half
in the case of silicon. But in silicon is not complete SP3 coordination.
Complete SP3.
That's in the case of complete SP3. So. This is what we're obtaining. So.
And this is then it's a photoelectric insulator?
Yes, this system, either system, graphene with SP3 coordination, is a photoelectric insulator with a half of the order of 1 mV. It's the same as silicon, but in silicon it's a little bit. It's higher. So, well, the main conclusion is that from that calculation that you induce SP3 distortion of the lattice preserving the inversion symmetry of the system, then you enhance the gain of the coupling a lot. So, it's natural to think about what's the role of flexural quantums, in particular the optical mode, when one two lattice. And the other so that is displaced. Yeah. One is with respect to the other plane direction. So then you can have this kind of processes, but mediated by quantums. I mean. You can go from pi to sigma by and then I mean, you can have these kind of processes mediated by, in the case of SP3, for instance, you have these kind of processes mediated by the utilization terms, and then here is the, So you can have the same kind of processes mediated by the quantums. So if you project out the sigma electronic state in a perturbative manner, what you obtain is something like a spin orbit mediated electron quantum coupling between the textual, the optical textual quantum and the pi electron, something like this, whose interaction vertex is going to have the same structure in sublattice, valley, and spin degree of freedom as the KML coupling, and which is going to be quadratic on the quantum fields, just to preserve also the mirror symmetry of the system. So this kind of spin orbit mediated electron quantum coupling can modify the single particle properties of pi electrons, in particular if you consider the first order self-energy diagram, which is something like this. It has no dependence on frequency and momentum, and this can be interpreted as a quantum to produce KML max. This is our estimate. This is our estimation. Gauss distribution for the quantum. Here we have assumed a flat branch for the orbital flexural mode, and this coupling from our triadic interpolation is estimated to be of the order of 0.1 electron volts. Meaning that the temperature doesn't play any role here, but the 0.1 motion contribution is remarkable. It's remarkable essentially because the carbon mass atom is weak, so our estimation for this Kelvin mass is of the order of 0.05, 0.1 milliliter volts. Well, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
You told us the size of the Rashba, and then you told us the dependence of your spin bias relaxation time on N, on the Gope, but what about the scale on it? Does that agree with the absolute value of it?
You mean the number of
yeah.
the spin? Well,
with the spin
that's one of the features of the spin time, because the spin relaxation time has much shorter than the theoretical structure ones. So probably because they are affected by the contact or any kind of. So that's why I think it's not important to get the number, the precise number of the test, which is the behavior as when you change the temperature or the concentration and so on. Just identify first which is the mechanism.
Okay, thank you very much. So how was the experience? Shall we repeat the exercise in, I don't know, a few weeks' time?
Yeah, very good.
Where shall we find young people?